The Metal AI Podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Felix Beecher, and this is the Medical AI Podcast, a 30-minute thrill ride of big ideas. We talk to a range of top guests, from industry innovators to scientists to philosophers. This is brought to you by Informatech, where I'm the head of healthcare technology.
Personalized medicine has been promised as a coming revolution in healthcare. The concept goes all the way back to Hippocrates around 400 years BC, but it is still very rare in clinical practice. Now, machine learning has been described as the key technology for personalized medicine. So, are we finally about to see this revolution storming the gates? With me to discuss this is one of the key figures in the area, Professor Richard Dobson, a researcher based at my own alma mater, King's College London. Richard, a very, very big welcome. I'm delighted to have you on.
Thank you very much, Felix. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Great. All right. Well, let's start off with just an introduction. Could you introduce yourself and a little bit about your research in this area?
Sure. So I'm a researcher in health informatics, and I'm based at King's College London and also at University College London. At King's, I'm based within the Department of Biostatistics and Health Informatics, which is at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience. And I'm also based at UCL, I'm based within the Institute of Health Informatics. And critically, part of the way that I work is I work across undertaking research, but undertake research within biomedical research centres. So these are government-funded centres that are partnerships essentially between hospitals and universities. And so there's one at the Maudsley, South London and the Maudsley at King's, and there's also one at UCLH, part of linked to UCL. And the aim of those partnerships is to foster and develop translational research, so research that is going to benefit the patient and benefit the health system in general. And so what we've been focusing on doing within my kind of particular domain is thinking about how we can take advantage of the digital revolution that's happened over the last 40 years or so, the advent of the internet, the advent of high computers with high amounts of computing power, the advent of the ability to molecularly characterize patients, the ability for us to be able to collect data from people's smartphones and wearable devices, for example. So this is just, there's been a data deluge, and our aim is to try to take advantage of that for furthering and bettering healthcare. And so, we've seen real advances in the fields of finance, marketing, and travel within the 21st century. All of these kind of domains take advantage of this opportunity around data. And we're wanting to do that for health so that we can understand diseases better and provide better healthcare. And we want to embed these technologies into the NHS. So my group specifically focuses on aspects of molecular data, so your genomic data or measures of your metabolites or your proteins, measures of how your genes are being expressed. We also focus on data that you generate when you are seen within by the healthcare system. So data that you generate as part of your interaction with the NHS, and then data that you generate outside of the healthcare system, the routine healthcare system, through data that you generate as part of everyday living. So data that's generated by you as you go about normal daily life. So your smartphone or your wearable devices. And so all of our research is guided by need and the priorities of patients and the NHS, the health system in general.
Okay, so essentially we're generating vast amounts of data all the time that could have medical benefits, and we at the moment that data is kind of wasted, right, for the most part.
Absolutely. So we spend, invest a huge amount of money generating data within the NHS, for example. We also generate it just as a byproduct of daily life. And so, yeah, what is the opportunity to use this data to streamline and make care better?
Okay, all right. Well, let's define personalized medicine. As you know, this is one of my favorite areas of research, and I've worked in this area myself. Could you tell us actually what the focus is here?
Yeah, so I mean, in the 21st century, everything's personalized, isn't it? When in the 20th century, the way we consume things was very much a one-size-fits-all approach. And so the way we shopped or the way we watched TV, we all sat down and we watched the same programs at the same time. Now we consume things, TV or products or you know anything in a kind of very kind of tailored way. So it's very personalized. It's very directed towards you or to people like you. And so you can sit and you can watch Netflix and you can consume that product at any time in any way, shape or form that you want to. So everything's becoming so much more tailored and personalized yeah. towards us as individuals. And so this is the basis of personalized medicine as well. So the aim here is to really use data such as our DNA genome or other data, other clinical data or diagnostic information to create what is a much more kind of tailored way, a bespoke way of treating you as an individual or a group of people. And so the aim is to try to use this in a number of ways, this kind of tailoring of approaches of medicine so that we can identify people that might be high risk and therefore prevent particular disorders from coming on. Or we can detect earlier and make more correct diagnoses. And we can choose the right treatment for you as an individual and also monitor you as an individual or a group of people, monitor the treatment for you. And so the aim is to really kind of, the drive of personalized medicine has really been around the idea of four Ps, as we call them. And these four Ps are around the prediction and prevention of disease, creating more precise diagnoses, creating personalized and targeted interventions, and also creating a more participatory role for patients. So we summarize those kind of four goals, if you like, as being four Ps of medicine.
Yeah, okay. So could you say something about what the problem that we're trying to address here is? Can you quantify the problem with so-called one-size-fits-all medicine?
Yeah, well, it's incredibly blunt, isn't it? Medicine as it's practiced. So you know, we take a one size fits all approach, and we kind of take a very kind of hit and hope approach to it as well. So we will kind of you will have experienced when you go to a doctor will assess you and look at you, and then they'll say, well, let's try you on this medication, and let's try you on this amount of medication, yeah. and let's see what happens. And so you know, that's quite a crude approach, and it would be much better if we could say, well, somebody with your genetic background and somebody with your family history and somebody that has a lifestyle such as yours and somebody, you know, that has other characteristics, somebody that has a pattern of sleep such as this or has a, you know, activity levels like you is more likely to respond to or get a better response to a particular medication. And so we'll start you off on that and we'll see what happens. But it's making, you know, it's taking all of this kind of extraneous information that we might have into consideration when you're deciding on a treatment plan for a particular person.
And I suppose that doctors in clinical practice, when they prescribe a particular medication or treatment for a patient for a particular disorder, they're probably trying to apply some kind of personalized medicine, but it's probably very intuitive and very hit and miss. Is that fair?
That's exactly right, I think. Yeah, it's very intuitive. And, you know, there's a huge amount of experience and knowledge within a clinician's head. And, you know, but there's also this additional information that we can use to add to that intuition and add to that instinct to provide, you know, additional knowledge. So that we're providing a more kind of 360 degree view of a particular patient to a clinician who then ultimately makes the decision. And, you know, we want to provide a clinician with information that means they're more informed and they, you know, they have more information at their fingertips.
Now, there have been studies which have looked at the efficacy of a wide range of common medications. Do you know about that kind of research? Can you summarize that, where we are with that?
So I think there are a few examples of kind of precision medicine or personalized medicine. And those include, you know, pharmacogenetic testing of genes to predict a patient's response to warfarin. So warfarin is prescribed to patients that, you know, are at risk of atrial fibrillation. And so, you know, by understanding what kind of genetic makeup you have, then you can get a better, you can make a prediction as to what a patient, how a patient will respond to a drug such as warfarin. So therefore, you know, creating much more tailored responses or a much more tailored kind of prescribing to a particular person. And I think another kind of example of this is also in targeted therapies indicated for treatment of breast cancer, for example, or tumor marking testing for diagnosing cancer. I think one that we think of here, which is an unanswered problem at the moment, is treatment-resistant schizophrenia. So, you know, working at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology, and Neuroscience, we're partnered with the Maudsley, as I said earlier. And so we're dealing with people, treating people with serious mental illness. And in schizophrenia, it's very much a kind of, you know, trial and error scenario, and you'll put somebody onto a series of medications and try them on those. And then as a last resort, or some way down the line, you'll put them on a strong medication such as clozapine. Now, it can take up to 8 years, 8 years on average, before somebody's given clozapine. And so there can be 8 years of kind of uncertainty and somebody being suboptimally kind of medicated or dealt with or treated during that whole time. So we really want to get to the point where we can identify much earlier on which person is going to not get a benefit from any of the existing medications and get them onto clozapine much earlier.
Absolutely. And look, I think with schizophrenia, just to take that example, it involves complexities and subtleties that people are probably generally not aware of. And what I mean is that schizophrenia is very much an umbrella term, right? It can describe a huge range of different kinds of completely different kinds of symptoms. And that's another source of variability in when you're trying to treat something with a particular drug.
Exactly right. And you're relying on the information that you collect in your assessment. So, you know, when somebody appears, maybe in a time of crisis, then you're relying on the information that you can get from them or the information that can be provided to you by a carer of theirs or other people. And so that's very kind of subjective information and, you know, it's obviously incomplete. And, you know, there are issues with recall. And so what we're trying to do is actually work out ways of creating more accurate and complete and objective kind of descriptions or views of people and patients so that we can tailor those interventions much more accurately.
Yeah. Okay. Now you have described your work as enabling a quote panoramic view of patients, I love it. It's a very clever wordplay. I love that. Can you just unpack what that actually means?
Yeah, so it really comes from the idea that we have, at the core, we have genomics. And genomics has come, represents a term that describes our genetics. And, you know, we have proteomics. So within the field of omics, we have genomics, and we have proteomics, metabolomics, and transcriptomics. All of these kind of represent different components of our kind of molecular profile. So our protein levels or our metabolites or our gene expression. And, you know, we can characterize those across the complete array, if you like, of proteins that we have or metabolites. And so you have those omic levels, if you like, or modalities, types of data. And so what we're doing, you know, with talking about panoramics is we're just expanding that view so that we have, on as well as those kind of molecular omic characteristics, we have other types of data as well. So it might be your environment, characterized as your environment omics, or it might be imaging data, or it might be, you know, your patient record data, your electronic health record data, or it might be data that you've generated through your smartphone or wearable devices. So it's all of these kind of layers stacked up on top of each other, representing this complex view of you as an individual and the interactions between those data, trying to characterize those and test for their associations with these kind of medical outcomes that are of interest.
Now, genetics and genomics is let's talk about that for a couple of moments. Obviously, if we are talking about one particular genetic marker, like you know the type of a particular gene, that's a very simple, small piece of data, right? But if you're throwing an entire genome into a model, then that's a very, very large piece of data. Now, where is it on that spectrum of complexity?
So we have, you know, we can characterize the whole genome, and so that's genomics, the whole lot, is 3.1 billion base pairs or letters long. So your genome is made up of letters. And you can, as you say, you can have variations within that genome at any particular point, and some of those may be important and for medical outcomes, and some may not be. So some may be functional, some may not be. And you know, this is the foundation of variation, really, and evolution is, you know, variations within the genome. Some of them are positive and cause a kind of competitive advantage, and some of them are negative, and some of them are benign. And so what we tend to find is, you know, it's very nice if you find one gene or one variant in one gene that's associated with, you know, response to a medication, for example. But often, you know, it's far more complicated and difficult than that, unfortunately. You know, if you have one variant which has a really massive impact, then, you know, that might be associated with disease, a specific disease, and it's, you know, and it's very highly heritable, or, you know, it's very easy to spot that, and the disease can be very kind of damaging. What we tend to find with complex disease is that, you know, you have this accumulation of variants, each one of which has a small effect. And so, you know, you might have a predisposition for depression, say, through one variant, but actually that's such a small effect that you really need to consider the accumulation or the load that you have across a large number of variants across the whole genome. And therefore you're thinking about that, you know, the effect at a whole genome level rather than just a single variant.
So I think one reason why this might be an important question is because it affects who can perform these kind of analyses, right? Because if you are just a kind of small amateur research team or a startup trying to develop something new, then to analyze whole genomic data, you're going to need a very, very powerful computer, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you think back to the 90s, when the first whole human genome was sequenced, and sequencing is what we call reading across the whole genome. You know, that took a number of years and a massive effort internationally to sequence a whole genome. And it cost, you know, an absolute fortune to do. Now you can sequence whole genomes at a fraction of the cost and at scale. And it's so you can do it, and you know, it is being done. We have projects such as the 100,000 genome project a few years ago within the UK, which aimed to sequence 100,000 people for cancers and rare diseases. And you'll sequence whole genomes, or sequence just the kind of what you think are the important parts, maybe the just coding bits, the genes. And you can do that. We do that a lot as part of research, because that's, you know, you want to discover where the variation is and the important variation. So you want to capture as much data as you possibly can. And we have, you know, we have research labs that will generate this data. There is obviously a cost attached to it. And, you know, it produces large amounts of data, and the analysis of whole genomes is hard to find these needles in the haystack. But once you have found them, then actually when you kind of translate that into practice, say you found a variant which is clinically useful, then you would not necessarily sequence the whole genome. You would be sequence assaying that particular part of the variation of the genome.
Okay, now a similar question on imaging as well, because having worked in imaging myself, you know, you can either throw an entire brain, for example, if we're talking about psychiatric diseases, or you can throw in very simple measures like brain volume. And those are, just in terms of computational crunching that needs to be done, those are two very, very different things, right? So again, where are you on imaging in terms of the complexity of the inputs?
Yeah, so I work with the output of imaging rather than working with imaging itself. So I don't necessarily process raw images. I rely on somebody to give me, say, a whole brain volume measure or a hippocampal volume measure, and then I kind of fold that into my other data sets. So I'm not kind of generating, working in the kind of raw images themselves.
Yeah, I see.
But we do, I mean, we have supercomputers that we work with and use, and we have those put established and deployed within hospital settings, so within the NHS firewall, so that we can kind of work directly on patient data. But we also have these trusted research environments that sit within the academic environment as well, within the university, where we have more flexibility to kind of build and scale supercomputers. And we're able to take anonymized data out of these hospital settings and put them into these trusted research environments, or TREs as we call them, where we're able to kind of scale this compute more flexibly. We also work with partners such as NVIDIA, so supercomputer providers and NVIDIA creates graphics processing units, GPUs as they call them, which were originally developed or have been developed for gaming, which we've found but have been incredibly useful for doing kind of highly parallel, highly computationally intensive machine learning. And so we load these, we kind of partner with NVIDIA and access their healthcare supercomputer where we need to.
Okay, now we could talk about this all day long. It's so interesting. There are a couple of other inputs into your models, which I'm really interested in. So I wonder if you could just briefly cover what kind of details that those might involve. One is environmental factors, another is data from wearables, another is speech, and another is social networks. Could you just briefly summarize how those feed into your models?
Yeah, so everybody's collecting data or generating data as part of daily life through their smartphones and wearables. And on your smartphone, you have a range of sensors that are on that phone. So you have a gyroscope and you have GPS, you have a light sensor, you have a battery sensor. Your phone is loaded with sensors. Many of us are also wearing devices such as Fitbits or Apple Watches. And these devices, as we know, have all got sensors as well. They'll track your heart rate and they track activity and sleep and things like that. And so, you know, we're trying to fold that kind of data in, because that data is objective data that you are generating continuously, pretty much 24/7, in periods of sickness, but also in periods of health. And so that's very valuable data. Additionally, we have information that's collected. We think that speech is a very important marker of health for a number of conditions. And so that's the things that you say themselves, but also how you say them. So the acoustic properties of what you say, and also, you know, kind of prosodic properties of what you say. And so we're trying to capture that. In terms of social networks, we're all kind of locked into social media. And, you know, the way that we interact, the content that we provide, the type of structure that we have within those social networks is all important and informative. So how many people you're connected to, the type of people that you're connected to, the various network properties of the social network that you sit within. So how central you are, how much information kind of flows through, how many followers you have, how quickly you respond to messages, all of that kind of thing is important. The type of language that you use, so the sentiment that you write with, the topics that you write about, is all useful information.
The speech thing is really especially fascinating, because actually, one of the first machine learning tools I developed was a diagnostic for Parkinson's, right? Which has a kind of characteristic speech. But I guess that also applies to depression, schizophrenia, maybe, obviously types of aphasia, clearly, but all sorts of things. I mean, can you unpack that briefly?
I think speech is a really interesting and underutilized marker of health, potentially. And so we're using it particularly to look at patients with depression, major depression, and characterize those. So both in terms of what they say, and there's some really interesting findings there, but how they say it as well. So, you know, things like the rhythm of the speech, the pitch of the speech, the number of pauses that somebody has, the volume and tone of the speech, all of that is, you know, is really kind of indicative of a person's state. There are many kind of, it's a really kind of complex machinery, speech, with many kind of cognitive, motor and motor type elements to it. So we're trying to pick apart those signals which are, which can be tracked and are associated with conditions, but also kind of aspects of speech which are associated with maybe more, don't say transdiagnostic, but, you know, things like fatigue, which maybe sit across, you know, a range of disorders. You know, it, you can imagine that fatigue could be quite nicely characterized through speech.
Yeah. Now, we've already briefly mentioned depression and schizophrenia. Now, these, I think, are those the two main disease areas that you're working on?
No. We're working across a range of mental health conditions, ADHD, autism, MS, epilepsy, Alzheimer's, dementias in general, as well as physical health conditions. But depression is a large part of what we do, and particularly within the mobile health space, where we're looking at mobile phones and wearable devices. Depression has been a really important piece of work.
Informally, my impression is that epilepsy is something that can be very successfully treated with pharmacological treatment. But when it comes to depression, the story is somewhat different, right? There have been lots of reviews and meta-analyses of pharmacological treatments for depression. And in general, they seem pretty underwhelming. So my question is, given that there are very serious questions about the efficacy of antidepressant pharmacological treatments, that seems to me to be a problematic area for personalized medicine to work in, because if the treatment doesn't work very well, or perhaps even at all, then it's very difficult to apply personalized medicine, because how can you possibly succeed where the treatment doesn't work very well?
Yeah, so obviously the treatment works for some people and doesn't work for other people, at least we think that. And, you know, there are pharmacological treatment approaches, and there are also non-pharmacological treatment approaches, such as CBT. And so I think, you know, depression is a really interesting one, because there are real issues around how we treat it and how we manage it. And so I think that's why it's a particularly important area for us to focus on within the mHealth mobile health domain, particularly. So what we've been doing as part of a European project called Radar CNS was looking to see whether we can track major depression symptoms using Fitbit devices and using people's phones to track their symptom progression and their symptom changes, and also detect and predict relapses. And so this is really important, you know, because we have the fact that it's very difficult to characterize a response, very difficult to characterize anyway, you know, objectively depression, because we're relying on subjective report, right? So it's very difficult to characterize objectively and track it and understand how factors such as sleep or activity will be interacting with treatment, you know, and affecting how a person responds or progresses or relapses with depression. So it's to get, we need to be able to get a much better feel to understand how well treatment is working. We need to be able to characterize symptom profiles much better as a start. In order to be able to generate better treatments, we also need to be able to design ways of, you know, using these ways of monitoring people better in order to understand whether drugs or medications in trials or interventions that are being trialed are having a positive effect. Because it's a way of measuring the response or of an intervention at the moment is a really kind of crude way, where we're relying on subjective reports. We're asking somebody maybe at a clinical visit how they were feeling 3 weeks ago, you know, or how they were sleeping 3 weeks ago. Now that's really kind of, it's going to be very difficult to characterize how well somebody's responding to a medication if you're relying on somebody being able to remember how they were feeling 3 weeks ago. Whereas if we have continuous objective monitoring of sleep, then we can have a much more fine-grained view on, you know, how people's symptoms are changing and how they're responding to whatever intervention is being trialed.
But no, that all makes perfect sense. But do you accept the premise of my question that you probably, I'm guessing, would be much more successful in developing personalized medicines or treatments where the treatment is successful, as in epilepsy, and not so much in with treatments that tend not to be very successful, as in depression?
Is that
the case?
That is the case, yeah, for sure. And you know, for something like epilepsy, you have a very clear outcome, don't you? A seizure.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what we've been doing with epilepsy is trying to use these devices to detect a seizure. So maybe a change in heart rate or change in skin conductance could be indicative of a seizure. And you can imagine it's much more clear, isn't it? Because you've got an outcome that you can very clearly kind of measure against. Somebody has a seizure or somebody doesn't have a seizure, and the number of seizures that they have. It's much more, you know, easier target. Yes, yeah.
Okay. So, Richard, on the basis of your research, what is the state of evidence that personalized medicine is working in terms of the systems that you have yourself developed?
Yeah, so if I give you, it's a good question, Felix. If I give you an example from the work that we're doing with electronic health record systems, as I was saying, you know, a lot of this information is stored in text, and it's distributed over a number of systems. So it's not like when you go into the NHS and have an interaction with the NHS, a doctor here, you know, in one department sees your results from another department. You know, a lot of the data is disconnected. And it's so doctors are acting kind of blind to this information quite a lot of the time. And so through the work that we developed, the ability to kind of suck information in and kind of make it available for search in near real time and then set up alerts, clinicians are able to be alerted to things, important events, much earlier. Okay. And see things, have things flagged to them that they otherwise wouldn't have seen. So one example of this is with a really kind of powerful treatment that's prescribed for rheumatoid arthritis, methotrexate. So this is a great medicine, but there's a danger that people can suffer from renal failure if they have an adverse response to it. Now, some of the tests for renal failure recorded within the text and kind of buried within the sea of information. And so we've developed as part of our tooling, we have this kind of bot that looks and checks for all new information coming in about a particular patient that's been prescribed or all patients that have been prescribed this powerful medication. And it will detect evidence of early signs of this kind of adverse drug response. And then it will alert the correct team to this event happening. And so that's, you know, a very kind of concrete example of, you know, as being able to use this data, have access to this data and react and respond to data that's created by the system and in the system in order to avert crises and safety events that are specific to you.
That's a really nice example. It's got nothing to do with genomics or omics at all, though, of course, right? So, I mean, how do you see those kind of the panoramic approach panning out? In terms of, have you got studies underway, for example, or what?
Yeah, so we need to be able to fold this information all together, don't we? So, you know, if we have somebody's genetic data in combination with their electronic health record data, in combination with their wearable data, then we have their background of genetics. We have the information that's being collected real time as they're moving through the healthcare system. and we have the information that's being collected about them remotely whilst in their home care setting. And that's very much the direction that we're going in. I mean, I think most of the things that we're doing now are tend to be working with one of those kind of components or pillars, if you like, rather than kind of working across. So we're struggling, I wouldn't say struggling, but it's difficult at the moment to kind of fold in somebody's Fitbit data to their electronic health record data. We're not doing that as such. We're looking at the moment within the mobile health world, we're kind of looking for markers which are, you know, we're at the research stage. So we're understanding what is likely going to be useful.
Okay, so now, because you are dealing with very complex data like genomics, and you're also dealing with a wide range of different types of data like genomics and environmental and blood work and patient records and whatever it might be, the model that you end up with, I would have thought, is going to end up as a very, very black box. Is that because it's basically going to be impossible to unpick the complexity of the model. Does that bother you at all? Do you think there are issues with that?
I think there are issues with black boxiness of models that we develop. We really want to be able to explain our models and why they've come to a decision that they have. And so that's a big part of what we do, is kind of trying to make models that are explainable and understandable. But we need to find a balance. I mean, there are probably always going to be the case that we have an element of kind of black boxiness about the things that we do. And I think we kind of have to work with that and mitigate against that. I mean, you know that there are drugs whose mechanisms we don't completely understand, but we still use them because we know that they do good.
Yeah.
And we can be confident in their behavior, and they have, you know, we've understood what they do, not necessarily how they do it. And so, you know, there can be the same kind of principle applied to AI technology and models and machine learning models that we're kind of building. And that's the aim, I think, is to characterize their behavior and understand as much as we can how they're getting to that decision. But as long as we can ensure that they make a prediction and they do it the same way every time, or, you know, we can be confident in their behavior, then we can kind of control or mitigate against that. And so it's really kind of a case of finding a balance between the risk and the benefit. And so that's really why we have to validate and verify and validate algorithms and work out what that balance is. And then, you know, it's why regulation is so important. We have to regulate everything that we're doing so that we're kind of keeping a lid and putting guardrails around the algorithms whilst still being able to kind of move forward and use them.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very sensible answer. And of course, it's a very live issue right now, because Sam Altman from, you know, the CEO of OpenAI was in Congress yesterday, right, being grilled.
Yeah.
And maybe you're going to be hauled before Parliament and grilled on the darkness of your black boxes. I don't know. Are you in discussions with government or the MHRA or what?
We are a little bit, yeah, and starting to be. You know, they've been reaching out a little bit more to find out what we're doing and how we're doing it. And, you know, it's very much a conversation that we want to welcome, or that we welcome. I mean, within the domain of medicine, we've been very, very careful for a very long time. And so we're used to kind of the concerns and the worries around the behavior of technology and the biases and risk and safety and, you know, making sure that, you know, we're not introducing more dangers.
And so that's right. Look, it's funny because people, you know, people are very wary about the black props. The black box problem right now, but people never worry about how their cars work or their phones work or anything else. Really, it's a curious double standard,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that's exactly right. So we have to get to the point that we're comfortable in how these things are behaving.
Right. So let's talk about implementation. So you're working with the NHS, and obviously we have a technology here which has an enormous amount of potential. The potential can hardly be overstated. And yet, as I said in my intro, if one goes to the doctor's currently it's extremely unlikely that one's personal characteristics are going to be taken into account in any kind of systematic way. So how far are we away from having a healthcare system where these kind of variables are taken into account and we have genuine personalized medicine, which is standard and common?
It's very difficult, isn't it? So we have a healthcare system which is essentially running on infrastructure which has some real kind of fundamental issues and is really creaking. And just actually keeping those systems going is a challenge in itself. And yet we have, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, we have, you know, innovation, and we have AI, and we have the huge advances in the data that we can generate and the amount of data that we can process and the insights that we can generate from this data. We've got this massive chasm between the two.
Yeah.
And so we need to get to the point that we can actually get those two kind of ends of the spectrum to meet in the middle. So firstly, being able to get the NHS to the point where we can kind of access data in a secure, safe way, in a timely way. So getting access to kind of real-time data or near real-time data, getting access to data that's linked across systems, and make that available for the technology to generate insights on and from, and then put those insights back into the NHS and put them into the hands of the people that need them, the right people at the right place, at the right time. And so that's, you know, that kind of plumbing and that kind of engineering is a massive challenge that is, I think we're trying to work across the systems that we've put into, such as Cogstack that we've put into hospitals, addresses that first problem of kind of surfacing, unlocking that data that's generated as part of routine care and making that available to downstream AI, turning that text into something that other machines can read and generate insights from, and then trying to get that information back to the clinicians and the care teams that they can then use.
I would imagine that you might find it quite frustrating because there is nothing very complicated these days about doing personalized medicine, right? I think the technology is there. We know how to do the research. We know how to build these models. But trying to get it implemented in a health system that is monolithic and Byzantine in its complexity is the real challenge, right? So the challenge is not really technical, I suspect. It's more bureaucratic. Is that kind of true?
Bureaucracy is a huge issue, yeah. So actually getting something taken up in the NHS has been a huge challenge of ours. You know, when it is kind of just trying to keep the lights on, then if you want to talk about implementing something new or innovating, developing, then, you know, there's no space, there's no time to adopt new technologies and to evaluate new technologies. So it's much easier just to say no, because there are insufficient resources or insufficient motivation to adopt and implement. There's also, you know, this perception of risk as well. So what people do with the data, can we be confident that, you know, the algorithm is regulated correctly? Can we be confident in this technology, the stack that we're putting in, that it's not going to introduce something that we hadn't anticipated? So all of these kind of, rightly so, are concerns that people have that sometimes prevent people from making a change or innovating or adopting because of there's a risk, and everybody wants to avoid, nobody wants to be on the front page of the Daily Mail for a data breach or, you know, an issue around, you know, introducing something that's unsafe. So in many respects, it's easier to just say, let's not do anything. Let's just keep going as we are.
Absolutely. Okay, well, look, Richard, last question is, nothing to do with your own medical AI systems. Could you say something? Could you give us your choice for your personal favorite current example of medical AI?
So I think the advances around large language models are really exciting and interesting. So we're all, you know, we've all been turned on to the potential of these chatbots such as ChatGPT and models such as GPT-4. You know, these models have been trained on such huge amounts of data that they've developed these emergent technology capabilities. such that they're able to write USAs or summarize documents or undertake kind of questions and answers and create images and create scripts and write songs and write poetry, all of this. Huge, huge opportunity, I think, for healthcare. So these models are tailored, trained on publicly available data. But if we can bring these models into the healthcare domain and the healthcare system, then they have potential to be truly transformative. I mean, clinicians and patients are already using them, you know, the public ones. So I think there's a really kind of exciting research going on around how these smaller models can be, that are open source and can be tuned on NHS data within the NHS, can then be established. And also combining those models with other types of data. So combining details from, or combining images from your, maybe your X-ray scan or your MRI, you know, combining that with the things that have been written, it provides, we'll then have a foundational models for medicine, which combine the, all of these kind of different types of data together, maybe your ECGs with your, the clinical reports and the imaging. And then that, what that will enable, hopefully, I think, is this idea of digital twins. And these digital twins are virtual representations of patients. And so we have digital twin representation of a physical twin generated from multimodal patient data and population data and real-time updates on patient and environmental variables. And so then we'll be able to kind of truly, the idea is that, you know, we'll be able to truly model random perturbations or interventions and explore expected behavior.
Which brings us very nicely back to personalized medicine. So exactly. Beautifully done. Richard, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. I'm very grateful for you, for your time. Thanks so much. It's been fascinating.
Thanks very much, Felix. Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I'm Felix Beecher. Ping me on LinkedIn for more information on Omdia's services in healthcare technology. See you next time.